All these last names sound like euphemisms for like nuts, undercarriages. Welcome back to Lyrics for Lunch. This is the show that each and every week asks you, what's your name and who's your daddy?
Is he rich like me?
I'm your host, Lindsay Tucker. Joining me this week and every week is Aviv Rubenstein. Aviv, hi.
Hi, how are you? I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing okay. You know, I just got my real estate license.
So hey, so if you're,
you want to buy a house in Colorado,
if you're in the Colorado area and you want to buy and sell a house, this is actually just a front for Lindsay's realty business. Reality business.
Or the realtor business will hopefully keep this podcast alive.
Yeah, that's more like it. That's your side hustle.
Yes.
It's a very busy week for both of us. So this is an episode that I have had in my back pocket for a couple of years in case there was, or a concept. I didn't do the research for it until recently, but a concept that I've had in my back pocket for a couple of years because I think the story is extremely interesting and super wild. But it does kind of relate to the last story that I told about Avril Lavigne.
Ooh.
So oh. There's a theme. There's a theme. The month of March, we got a theme.
Bonnie Dimples?
Maybe. What are we talking about today, Lindsay?
Today we're talking about this time in the season.
Time of the season. Yeah.
For loving.
Do you happen to know who sang that song?
The Mamas and the Papas.
Oh, incorrect. All right. So this is even better. All right, ready?
I'm sure I do know. I just can't remember. Sure. Who is it?
Well, it's the fourth word of my script, so you'll find out in four words.
Okay.
In 1969, The Zombies, you know the band that sang She's Not There and Tell Her No and Time of the Season, which is our song of the week, they were playing a show in Texas. And this wouldn't be notable for any reason other than on that same day, The Zombies, you know, the band that sang She's Not There and Tell Her No and The Time of the Season, which is our song of the week, were also playing a show in Michigan, which wouldn't be notable for any other reason than neither of those bands was the band The Zombies. You know that band that sang She's Not There, Tell Her No, and Time of the Season, which is our song of the week. So taking a big step back, I'm really outdoing myself. We're not doing a Was Born. We're doing the English word zombie was first recorded in 1819 in a history of Brazil by the poet Robert Southey in the form of zombie, Z-O-M-B-I, zombie. And other dictionaries trace the words.
Zombie, zombie.
It's almost as though you know what song we're going out on. Dictionaries trace the word's origin to African languages relating to words connected to gods, ghosts, and souls. One of the first books to expose Western culture to the concept of zombies was W.B.C. Brooks' book, The Magic Island, which came out in 1929. And these zombies, the book is an account of a narrator who encounters a voodoo cult in Haiti. I don't know why I said that. In Haiti. And they, the cult like resurrects their masses, and the zombies are voodoo resurrections of the cult members.
The zombies are voodoo resurrections. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. So what do you know about zombies? What are the rules of zombies if you were going to sit down and watch a zombie movie?
You can't kill them unless you drive a stake through their heart.
No, those are vampires.
They're undead, dead things, and they want to eat your flesh and turn you into a zombie.
Correct. Specifically, they have a thirst for brains. That is the brains. Modern. And so the origin of like how they became zombies, evolves, but
depends on the story.
Yeah. So The Magic Island, the book by W.B. Seabrook, was adapted into a 1932 film called White Zombie, in which the zombies were reanimated from the dead via Haitian voodoo. And then in July of 1953, Atlas Comics, which was a precursor to Marvel, released the fifth issue in their Menace series, which was like an anthology of horror comics. And that issue was called Zombie, and it featured a body climbing out of what looks like a pit of sludge.
Okay, so it's a little pixelated, so I feel like it's like Dick Tracy and Madonna and some cops, sure. And they're like, Oh my god, there's a dead thing coming out of the ground, yeah, which has turned, the street just turned into mud.
Into mud, right? And so a new version of the concept of the zombie, distinct from the Haitian folklore thing, which dominated the first 100 years of understanding of what a zombie was, that emerged in popular culture in 1968. The interpretation of a zombie as an undead person that attacks and eats the flesh of living people is drawn largely from George A. Romero's film Night of the Living Dead from 1968. And that was partially inspired by the novel I Am Legend from 1954. And so
Are these modern day movies too?
Night of the Living Dead?
And I Am Legend?
I Am Legend. So I Am Legend was remade as a Will Smith joint. But
a dog?
With a dog, yes. But I Am Legend, the book, is significantly different than the movie. And there have been several movie adaptations of I Am Legend, including one called The Omega Man. But
is the Night of the Living Dead like the thing that the Shaun of the Dead was spoofing? Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. So our understanding of modern zombies comes from Night of the Living Dead. But the word zombie is not used in that movie. It was later applied by fans, right? They called these creatures zombies. So George Romero released a series of zombie films, including Dawn of the Dead from 1978, which I believe does use the term zombies, and Return of the Living Dead from 85. And Return of the Living Dead is the first movie where the introduces the concept of zombies eating brains.
So in the beginning, they're just like flesh eaters.
Mm-hmm. In the beginning, they're just, honestly, they're undead slaves. They're like Haitian reanimated, like mummies, like reanimated corpses doing the bidding of their voodoo masters. Then they turn into flesh eaters, and now they're brain eaters.
We could totally party with the Haitians.
And the cause of zombism ranges from Haitian voodoo to hell is full.
Zombism, huh?
Zombism, zombieism.
It's like, that makes it sound like a choice.
Yeah, right. You're being very zombie phobic right now.
Oh shit.
Yes.
Check myself.
So originally it was Haitian voodoo, and then in the like George Romero era, it was just that hell was full. That was the explanation. It's just like, we're all so horrible. Hell is full. The dead walk the earth. And then now the widely accepted the modern cause of zombieism is some sort of version of like the rabies virus that causes people to thirst for brains. A la 28 Days Later or something.
Yeah. I was going to ask about that because it seems like there are like zombies and then there are like the 28 Days Later mutations.
Right. Who are technically not undead and who are fast, which makes them not zombies, but they started the zombies are fast craze in the early 2000s. I love 28 Days Later. I think it's like a really fantastic film. The argument of whether or not they are officially zombies is like kind of irrelevant to me. But yeah, it is dealing with the tropes of zombies so much so, this is a small digression, that in 28 Days Later, the first infected that you see is a priest who has two broken legs. And so he is shambling toward the main character played by Oscar winner Cillian Murphy, like a traditional zombie would, playing with the expectations of a zombie movie. And then all the others get up and start to run. And it's one of the scariest moments in any movie. So I think it is technically a zombie movie, even though they're not technically zombies. Night of the Living Dead, they're not technically zombies either.
What is a zombie anyway?
Exactly. So the actual band, The Zombies, formed at St. Albans School in Hertfordshire, England in 1961. The founding members are Paul Atkinson on the guitar, Rod Argent on the keyboard and vocals, Paul Arnold on bass, Hugh Grundy on the drums, and Colin Blunstone on vocals.
All these last names sound like euphemisms for like nuts, undercarriages.
Yeah, or like blowjobs. She gave him the old Grundy, the old Blunstone, the old Paul Arnold.
Oh, that's too good.
And they were all around 16 years old when they formed the band. This is a like high school teenage band. Were originally named the Mustangs, and they soon realized that there were other groups with that name. And according to Colin Blunstone, who of the like as the zombies get older and go through time, Rod Argent and Colin Blunstone become like the core members of the group. So according to Colin Blunstone, quote, every young band wants an original name. We were just in our teens. We tried the Mustangs. To be honest, I didn't really know what a zombie was. It was Paul Arnold, the bassist, who came up with the Zombies. This is from Rod Argent. He said, quote, well, we chose the name in 1961, and I mean, I knew vaguely that they were sort of, you know, the Walking Dead from Haiti, and Colin didn't really even know what they were. It was Paul that came up with the exact name. I don't know where he got it from. He very soon left the band after that.
So we've been criticized in the past for, like, asking if everything's racist, but is this racist?
The original depiction of zombies in movies is definitely racist.
Okay.
It's like deepest, darkest Haiti, and they bring people back to life. It's as racist as something like Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Mm-hmm. Which is racist. Mm-hmm. Is the band calling themselves that? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. Especially because, like I said, it would be like calling themselves the Mummies. Mm-hmm. Like, are they stealing from Egyptian culture? Not really. It's more. I think it had been kind of adopted by the pop culture at that point. Would it be like offensive to Haitian people? I don't think so. So Paul Arnold left the band because he wanted to become a physician. He became a doctor, and he was replaced by this dude, Chris White. But Paul said, quote, I thought this was a name that no one else is going to have, and I just liked the whole idea of it. Colin was very wary, I'm sure, at the beginning, but I always, always really, really liked it.
Okay.
But either way, this wasn't the Bloodthirsty Rage zombies that we think of today. It was like naming your band the Frankensteins.
It's always seemed like a very benign name to me.
Yeah, I think it is. The depiction of them in White Zombie in the movie is not great. But by the time it makes its way to the band, I think it's relatively harmless.
I mean the band name.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. I'm agreeing. They're all white because they're from England and their names are like Colin Blunstone and shit. In 1964, the band won a 250-pound cash prize in a beat group competition organized by the Watford Borough Council and sponsored by the London Evening News. Beat groups, or beat music, was the name of the new style of British rock and roll that was developing with bands like the Beatles and the Searchers. The genre melded influences from British and American rock and roll bands, R&B, skiffle, traditional pop, and this was the British invasion. The thing that they were invading into the United States was this beat music, quote-unquote beat music or beat groups. It was just like
Doug Funny's band, The Beats.
The Beats. Well, he's not in The Beats. He just loves The Beats.
Oh, his favorite band.
Yeah.
What's his band called?
I don't remember, but he sang Bangin' on a Trash Can.
And Killer Tofu.
Killer Tofu was The Beats.
Oh, fuck.
I Need More Allowance and Killer Tofu was The Beats. Bangin' on a Trash Can was Doug's band. Listeners, let us know what Doug's band was called. Oh, it's factually correct. Let us know what Doug's band was. So they signed, part of this cash prize was they had to like play a song. The song was picked. It was like the Watford Borough Council version of Eurovision. And so they signed a contract with Decca Records because they played their like original first hit song at this competition, and that song was called She's Not There. And the song was released in mid 1964. It peaked at number 12 in the UK. It was their only UK top 40 hit. And
ever.
And
it was their first song.
Yeah, first ever song. It's their Mr. Brightside. And it even caught on in the United States and climbed to number 2 in early December of 1964. It sold over 1 million copies.
The Killers definitely had more number ones.
Yeah, but the Killers' first song was Mr. Brightside.
Let's not give them the wrong idea.
Well, whatever. So this is from Caro Pop. Released in 1964, it's got a jazzy swing and cool quality that set it apart from the bulk of British Invasion releases. So let's take a listen to She's Not There. I'm sure that you...
She's not there!
I'm not sure if you've heard the song.
No? That wasn't it. Oh. I just made that up. We'll know when I heard it, if yeah. I've heard it. But at this point, we don't know.
I think you'll recognize it.
Well, no one told me. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, classic 60s kind of proto psychedelic song.
Yeah.
This also, there's a cover of this song on the Kill Bill soundtrack. It's pretty good.
Kill Bill 1?
2? I think it's playing when she steals BB from Bill.
I like 2.
I like samurai movies better than westerns, so I always like 1 better.
Okay, fair.
But I like them both. This is back to Caro Pop. One key element was Colin Blundstone's intimate vocals. He could sound sweet, whispery, and wistful, and then would add grit for the R&B covers that the Zombies, just about every other British Invasion band, were doing. So their first release was this with this album called Begin Here, and it was like a combination of singles and some American R&B covers. My favorite of which is a song called I Got My Mojo Working. This is my favorite version of I Got My Mojo Working. So let's take a listen to the R&B covers that they did, or one of the R&B covers that they did.
I got my mojo working, but it just won't work on you. I got my mojo working, but it just won't work on you.
Not loving this.
Oh, you don't like it?
Not my thing.
Oh, I love it. I also hear like the influence in like artists like Iggy Pop. As I mentioned, this album, Begin Here, was a collection of singles. It wasn't really thought of as an album. The U.S. version included another hit single called Tell Her No. So in 1967, frustrated by their continuing lack of success, the Zombies signed a recording contract with CBS Records, and they recorded a follow-up album that was supposed to be like an album, right? As opposed to a collection of singles.
Sure.
So the Beatles are starting to do like things like Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which is an entire experience, right? And so the Zombies wanted to do something similar, and their album is called Odyssey and Oracle. And they even recorded it at Abbey Road Studios, and their budget was not big. They couldn't hire a bunch of session musicians like the Beatles could, string sections and all that shit. So they used a Mellotron to fill out their arrangements, which is like a little keyboard. Mm-hmm. And according to Rod Argent, they used John Lennon's Mellotron, which had accidentally been left in the studio after the Beatles recorded Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Nice.
Yeah. And so for the
little mojo for your mojo.
Little mojo for your mojo, even though that song's not on that album. So for the album cover, the Zombies asked an art teacher friend of theirs named Terry Quirk to draw a like proto psychedelic album cover.
Okay.
And so this is the cover for Odyssey and Oracle.
A butt.
There is a butt.
There's some couples throughout.
There's some couples.
There's someone that looks like in a psych ward outfit or something, like breaking free.
Like a straitjacket thing. What about the text?
It's your typical like psychedelic hippie writing.
How do you spell the word Odyssey, Lindsay?
I don't know.
It's spelled O-D-Y-S-S-E-Y. So Terry Quick misspelled the word Odyssey on the album cover, and no one cared to fix it.
Great.
So Terry Quirk was...
I think it's an alternate spelling.
Yeah, I said Terry Quick, too, because I'm an idiot. Terry Quirk was Colin Blunstone and Chris White's childhood friend, and he was living with Rod Argent in sharing an apartment during the album's recording. And Terry Quirk says, quote, "There's a lot of theories online about why it's spelled wrong, but there's no conspiracy.
It was just a mistake."
It was just a mistake, yeah. And retroactively, the misspelling of the word Odyssey was thought to be some sort of in-joke or in-reference to, like, psychedelia or, I don't know, it's just bullshit. They just made a mistake, and it was too late to fix it. But Odyssey spelled that way is, like, how that record is now. Like, you have to spell Odyssey wrong to find it in the record store.
I feel like there's all kinds of weird artistic spellings of things.
For sure. This isn't one of those.
Okay.
And it sounds kind of proto-psychedelic in a way that I like more than the Beatles. When the Beatles get weird, I don't love it as much as this. The first single, the ultra-catchy, tongue-in-cheek, this is from Caropop, ultra-catchy, tongue-in-cheek, Care of Cell 44, was another flop. As was the second single, which is called Friends of Mine. They both came out in late 1967. So this is quickly Care of Cell 44. Care of Cell 44 is a song about the narrator waiting for his lover to be released from prison.
What the fuck?
And like writing love letters, Care of Cell 44.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I really like this song. I like this whole album.
I think I can hear everything because I only have one ear working.
Oh yeah, so that's an interesting predicament that you're in, actually.
So this was a flop. It sounds good from my hearing half the sounds.
Fun fact for listeners: Lindsay's headphones are broken, and so she can only hear out of her left speaker. And weirdly, that wouldn't be an issue because the record was originally produced in mono, which means both speakers play the same exact thing. But because the Beatles were doing stereo recordings and this was like the new thing, Blunstone and Argent, who were the songwriters and therefore got paid a little bit more but via the sales of their previous songs, paid money out of their own pocket to have this mastered in stereo, which is why Lindsay can't hear it. So the band was experiencing a declining demand for live appearances, and before...
Hold up.
Yeah.
They were... when were they experiencing a demand for live experiences?
Appearances?
Appearances.
So this is 1967, right? They are playing around universities and stuff, and they, you know, are playing these gigs, and she's not... She's Not There was like a big hit in the UK. It was number 12. And then 2 years later, 3 years later, their popularity is dwindling because this is before Odyssey and Oracle come out. Care of Cell 44 came out but flopped. And so they're not, their populations are, their popularity isn't growing like they wanted it to be. And in fact, it was dwindling a little bit.
Okay.
So before Odyssey and Oracle comes out, but after the two singles, Care of Cell 44 and Friends Like These, Friends of Mine, they split up. They break up. Their final gig was mid-December 1967.
R.I.P.
Exactly. Exactly right. More right than you know. So in April of 1968, Rod Argent, who was then just 22 years old, explained the reason for the band breaking up, saying, quote, "We don't want to end up playing for £20 a night in third class ballrooms. We are still big in demand on the university circuit and we're getting lots of work, so we want to quit while the going is good.
We're getting tons of work, so we're just gonna quit.
That's what he said.
Okay.
So here's where things get a little strange. In April of 1968, Odyssey and Oracle is released, and the album suffered poor sales. And it wasn't even going to be released in the U.S., but a musician named Al Cooper, not to be confused with Alice Cooper, Al Cooper, Cooper with a K, was in a band called Blood, Sweat, and Tears. You know Blood, Sweat, and Tears? They sang, I had to look it up, they sang What Goes Up Must Come Down, Spinning Wheel, Round and Round.
Can you please sing it?
What goes up must come down, spinning wheel, round and round. So Al Cooper from Blood, Sweat, and Tears was signed to Columbia Records, and he had heard the Zombies album and convinced the label of the album's merits. And so Columbia releases Odyssey and Oracle on its subsidiary called Date Records.
So is this a re-release?
No, it's a first release in the U.S.
Okay.
But it is 8 months after it's released in the UK, it finally makes it to America under like a subsidiary of Columbia.
Okay.
And the single was Time of the Season. That was the first single of the US release of Odyssey and Oracle. And it spent a long period as, quote, a sleeper. But eventually in 1969, it grew to become a nationwide hit in the U.S. and it peaked on the Hot 100 at number 3.
Time of the Season?
Time of the Season. So let's take a listen to Time of the Season.
It's the time of the season when love runs high. In this time, give it to me easy and let me try with pleasured hands to take you in this time to promised lands, to show you everyone it's the time of the season for love.
You asked me if I'm going to talk about the Summer of Love. This corresponds nicely to the Summer of Love, which was in 1967, and basically was just like the beginning of the hippie movement, right? Like people were doing
Ashbury,
free love, shit like
free
that.
Love and stuff.
So this provided the backdrop, especially in the United States, almost exclusively in the United States, of like the counterculture is no longer these beat groups and black turtlenecks, but you know, the hippies, free love, lots of drugs.
But even like the show me, let me show you everyone, right? Like,
oh, so you think that part of that is that like...
I feel like the lyrics had something to do with that culture.
I don't think that that is incorrect. So the backdrop of this becoming a hit in like mid-1969 is reflective of culturally like where America and like the youth and the counterculture was at. I think what this is one of the great rock and roll songs of all time. I love this song.
Yeah, it's a good song. I feel like it makes it into a lot of pop culture, like film and TV.
60, yeah, it does. And it's still bar, you know, it's obviously way more psychedelic and kind of, you can see it approaching stuff that's more similar to something like The Doors than She's Not There, which was a little bit more poppy, but it definitely is still taking that R&B influence because the bass line is just Stand By Me. The Benny King song is like the base of the song is just a riff on Stand By Me, which came out 6 years before this.
Whenever You're in Trouble, Won't You?
Yeah, because the bass line of that is bum, 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 bum.
Oh, yeah.
Bum, bum,
oh,
bum.
Totally.
Same bass line.
Got it.
Okay, so let's do a quick analysis of the lyrics.
It's the time of the season when love runs high. In this time, give it to me easy. And let me try with pleasured hands to take you in the sun, to promise lands, to show you everyone. It's the time of the season for loving.
What's your name? Who's your daddy? Is he rich like me? Has he taken any time to show you what you need to live? Tell it to me slowly. Tell you what I really want to know. It's the time of the season for loving. And that's it. Let me just do that again. So what do you think the song is about?
So I have zero factual information about what this song is about. However, when you told me that we were doing this song this morning, I was like, what do I think this song is about? I think it's about a sugar daddy grooming a sugar baby in the summer of 1967.
I mean, potentially. I don't know that it's necessarily sugar daddy, especially because these guys are 22 years old at this point. So, like, how sugary?
Why does it have to be autobiographical?
Every song's you know this. Every song's autobiographical. Yeah, I think it is just a seduction, and it's like, I don't know. Let me try with pleasured hands is pretty. It's pretty sexy.
Yeah, I think so.
So we have a hit song. The song goes to number 3 in the United States. But we have a problem. The band is broken up. So Rod Argent and Chris White had formed a new band called Argent. Colin Blunstone took a job in an insurance office. So this is from a BuzzFeed article called The Strangest Con in Rock History. And it's written by Daniel Ralston. So we're going to hear a lot from Daniel for the rest of the episode. He's going to take us through almost the entirety of the rest of the episode. The Zombies, unaware of their stateside success, parentheses, this was possible in 1969, had already moved on to new musical projects and day jobs. And this vacuum meant that anyone could tour the United States pretending to be the Zombies.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes. As the British invasion spurred rock culture's explosion in the 60s, there simply weren't yet enough of these upstart bands touring North America to meet the demand. So they made some up. This is where a group called Delta Promotions comes in. Delta Promotions was based in Bay City, Michigan. Delta Promotions was owned by Bill Kehoe and Jim Atherton, and they managed local bands in Michigan such as Question Mark and the Mysterians.
No.
Yeah. So a quick digression into Question Mark and the Mysterians. The band members were all children of migrant farm workers who settled in Michigan. And they even had a hit in 1967 called 96 Tears, which I guarantee you've heard. You just didn't know it was this band.
Oh, my God.
You know the song, right?
Yeah.
So this
is Question Mark?
Question Mark and the Mysterions. I fucking love this song.
They seem like a legit band in their own right.
They are a
Question Mark.
They are a legit band in their own right, but they were at this time local to the Michigan, the Michigan area. Right. And so Delta Promotions, this was like their flagship group because they had a hit and they were managing Question Mark.
Oh, okay. So this is just their like.
This is who they were before. This is their golden goose. Yeah.
Okay. Are the Question Marks going to become the Zombies?
No. But you're getting warmer.
Okay.
So Bill and Jim were half Bill. Kehoe and Jim Atherton of Delta Promotions were happy to fill a void created by a broken up band with a hit record. So this dude, Tom Hokut, was the first employee of Delta Promotions, and this is from the BuzzFeed article, quote, "He reluctantly agreed to meet me at a Chili's outside of town to discuss his time with Delta Promotions."
I'm honestly surprised Chili's is that old.
No, this is, so this article is from 2016.
Oh, okay.
When we sit down to eat, he places a manila envelope on the table. He keeps his hands on it while telling me the story of his involvement with the fake zombies.
Oh my God.
So this is from Tom. Before the decline of the major label system and the rise of internet and social media, enterprising and less than scrupulous businessmen ran the industry with relative impunity, with artists serving as primary commodities to be exploited. Famously, Elvis's manager, Colonel Tom Parker, pocketed anywhere from 25 to 50% of the star's gross income for the duration of his career. Alan Klein, who managed the Rolling Stones after the release of I Can't Get No Satisfaction in 65, promptly signed the band's publishing rights over to his own company, resulting in a string of lawsuits spanning decades. And so if this treatment was the norm for the era's biggest stars, it's not hard to imagine how lesser lights would fare. Delta promoted its groups and put on shows at a venue called Band Canyon, which was owned by Bill Kehoe. So he's already self-dealing.
Okay.
Quote, "I remember it starting out pretty legitimate," Tom Hokut says. "Then Kehoe and Atherton started telling me that they'd acquired the rights to the music and the names of these bigger bands like the Zombies. And I knew it was probably bullshit, but I didn't care. I was happy to be working in music." Hokut is the only Delta Promotions employee who would talk about the operation. And Bill Kehoe died in 1990. And as for Jim Atherton, Tom Hokut heard a rumor that he had been shot in Grand Rapids a few years after Delta Promotions folded.
What?
Attempts to locate Atherton were unsuccessful. So, Delta Promotions was the first to notice that the Zombies were a hit in America, but there was no band to play the songs. So the plan was simple. Find competent musicians, convince them that Delta Promotions was on the level, get them to a reasonable point of Zombies-like ability, and send them on the road. Once the prep was completed, they'd send the bands on tour while Delta took a healthy slice of the profits. And they stayed in Bay City, quietly isolated from any prominent record labels or magazines, and it proved the perfect spot to operate because they were in relative obscurity, and they sent the fake bands into metropolitan areas to absorb all the risk while Jim Atherton, Bill Kehoe, and Tom Hokut laid low.
All right, so yeah. You're saying to absorb all the risk, so there is risk. This is not legal.
No, this is absolutely not legal. The thing about like, oh, we bought the rights to these band songs, total bullshit.
Did not
happen. I mean, they said it happened, but it did not happen.
But people who go and book this, they think they're seeing the Zombies.
Yes.
So people out there probably still think they saw the Zombies, but they did not.
Correct. Delta Promotions put together a fake Dallas-based Zombies band featuring drummer Frank Beard and bassist Dusty Hill of future hit rock band ZZ Top.
Oh my God.
Yeah. 2/3 of ZZ Top were in this fake fake Zombies band.
So what's the guy's name? Bill and Tom?
Yeah. Bill.
They kind of know what's up.
Bill and Jim. Yeah, they kind of know what's up.
Like they have a good eye for talent?
I guess so. This is back to BuzzFeed. Before he joined Dusty Hill and Frank Beard in the Texas band that passed itself off as the Zombies, Mark Ramsey was was 18 years old and living in the outskirts of Dallas. He was good looking, and he had a sweet girlfriend named Vicky, and he loved to play the guitar. During his senior year of high school, a Texas blues band called The Gentlemen came to play a school-sponsored rock concert featuring a neighborhood hotshot guitarist and future fellow fig zombie, Sebastian Meter. The Gentlemen had scored a minor hit with their single It's a Crying Shame in 1966 when Meter was only 16, and Mark Ramsey couldn't pass up the opportunity to introduce himself. Ramsey remembers meeting Frank Beard, who's the drummer, later at a spot in Fort Worth called Pizza Inn, where they became fast friends. Beard knew everyone in the Dallas music scene and was noted for playing a drum kit with two bass drums, the mark of a badass drummer in 1969. Beard was already friends with Dusty Hill, and he took Ramsey to see Dusty's band American Blues. And so it wasn't long after that that Mark Ramsey got the call to join the Fake Zombies, which at the time featured Beard, Hill, and Meter. And he isn't exactly sure how the offer came about and is unsurprisingly fuzzy about some of the details of this era. Quote, the 60s were consumed with the fascination of experimentation. Frank was the one who approached me. So Frank Beard, Dusty Hill of ZZ Top declined to be interviewed for this story, but they did acknowledge that, like, BuzzFeed sent out like a fact check question, and Dusty Hill acknowledged that the facts were of this story are true, which is the first time that any ZZ Top member has publicly acknowledged their involvement in this Fake Zombie scheme.
Wow.
So
how did this writer get on this case?
I don't know. This is incredible, but like, you know, BuzzFeed has closed its like journalism wing or whatever, but this is like incredible investigative journalism.
Yeah.
So Mark Ramsey believes that they were connected with Delta Promotions through someone that Sebastian Meter met on tour with the Gentlemen, and the musicians were told that the operation was perfectly legal. This is what he says. As far as the Zombies, I was told that they didn't exist, that they were only a studio sound. And I was just excited and flattered. I had only been playing for a few years and the other guys were pro level at that point. So we talked a little bit about this last week of like bands that only exist in the studio. So this is the line that they were giving the musicians is, oh, the Zombies aren't real people. It's a fake band. And therefore we were able to buy the rights and you can be the Zombies. It's like not a big deal.
How long do you go before you find out? You don't hear it on the radio? Oh, well, it's a studio sound, but so you already think, oh, it's not real.
Yes. So he says, quote, I didn't look at it as anything more than a chance to have some fun, hang out with some cool guys, learn some songs, and go somewhere outside of this hillbillyville and earn a little money. As a warm-up for the Zombies tour, Delta Promotion asked the Texas Zombies, I'm going to refer to them as the Texas Zombies, to go on a short tour as a different, less successful band called the Rose Garden. The Rose Garden was a Los Angeles folk rock band who had a top 20 hit in 1967 with the song Next Plane to London. And so they're like, okay,
take the last plane to London and I'll meet you at the station.
Is that right? Is that what this is?
No, it's the last train. That's a Monkey song.
Yeah, but it might be because the Monkees were the studio sound band. So, okay. So, but like, can you imagine? Okay, guys, we're super psyched that you're going to be the Fake Zombies, but we need you to be the Fake Rose Garden to see if our scheme, our perfectly legal scheme, will work. And so, The Next Plane to London was the only Rose Garden song they bothered to learn, and the rest of the set was just blues. So they did a small run of shows in the South, and it went off without incident. So this is the real Rose Garden doing Last Plane to London. I'm sorry, Next Plane to London. You said Last Plane, and I got confused.
I think you said Last.
I may have. The song's called Next Plane to London.
The next flight to London will be boarding in 5 minutes.
Next plane to London, leaving on runway number 5. Next plane to London, and I'm missing him, that baby of mine. Told him I was gonna be a star, but to do it I would have to go far.
Is there anything that you notice?
Woman in this
yes,
band.
There is. Audiences were so starved for live music that no one confronted the fake Rose Garden, despite the fact that the real Rose Garden had a woman singer. His name was,
and the vocals are from a woman's point of view.
Yeah, Diana DeRose. And DeRose hailed from West Virginia, but reportedly told people that she was from Blackpool, England.
Hilarious.
So people did start asking where the girl was, but we did okay. This is what Dusty Hill said. The lack of repercussions emboldened them when they decided to tour without a keyboard player for the Zombies gigs. Ramsey remembers that Frank Beard told people on tour that their keyboardist had gotten busted in Dallas and was stuck in jail. And that's why he wasn't there.
Badass.
After this Rose Garden tour, Ramsey, Meter, Hill, and Beard headed to Michigan to meet with Delta Promotions team, and they got their photos taken, and they started their run as the Zombies, and they were told to use their own clothes for the shoot, so they wore cowboy hats.
Oh, no.
But Dusty and Frank both used stage names when they signed the promo photo, so this is Mark Ramsey, he says, so it's almost like they knew something was wrong here. Sebastian signed his real name, like me, probably because, like me, he didn't think we were doing anything wrong. Delta had a history of shady business ventures. Early in Tom Hokut's employment, he, along with a few other employees, including owner Jim Atherton, were busted for selling drugs out of the Delta offices.
Oh my God.
The police also found firearms on the premises, and Hokut spent a few nights in jail. He believes his boss, Bill Kehoe, pulled some strings with friends and local government to get him out. And the charges against all of them were dropped. So, June 22nd, 1969, was a rough night for the Texas Zombies. According to the Saginaw News, the band were, quote, especially disappointing, and the crowd began to leave during their fourth tune. The newspaper also says that the band didn't sound like they did back when they were selling millions of records. The change in sound is attributed to, quote, a complete transition of band members except the bass player.
That's what they said?
That's what the newspaper said. Now, this turns out to be one of Bill Kehoe's, like, he would say, oh yeah, all the members are different, but the original bassist is there. That's why we can still call them the Zombies. Even though that was a lie. This was like one of the lies he would tell news outlets when they asked him about these fucking group of jokers.
Okay.
So locally produced rock shows were often a disorganized mess, and most local reviews from the era mentioned bad sound, shoddy playing, and unimpressed audiences. But the fake Zombies fared no worse than the real ? And the Mysterians, who were themselves something of an off-brand version of their original incarnation by 1969, because Bill Kehoe replaced every one of the members except for one.
What? Why?
Because I guess they didn't want to do it, or they didn't want to do it for that kind of pay. But like one by one, the ? And the Mysterians, they all left as well. And Bill Kehoe's like, no, the fuck you're not.
It's okay. So he's touring them and they're not them.
They're not them either. Yeah. And so Delta kept its operations simple. Tom Hokut says that the concert promoters in most cities knew that they were getting fake versions of the real bands, but they operated as independent entities, each taking huge percentages of the money earned. And the bands had little recourse in asking for more money. Mark Ramsey remembers earning about $200 a week. As for the fans who were getting swindled, Tom Hokut says, when they were told, here's the Zombies, they bought it. Even the strange parts, like the fact that they were touring without a keyboardist, fans left disappointed and the band left town as quickly as possible. The less remembered, the better. Then these guys came along.
Hip.
That's right. Delta put together a second fake Zombies band that we will call the Michigan Zombies.
Like, why?
So Tom Hokut finally...
Can't they fake anyone else?
Oh, they did. Don't worry. So Tom Hokut opens the manila envelope that he's like clutching at the Chili's. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he hands the writer a stack of photos from the other fake Zombies band. They're dressed in muted, vaguely psychedelic garb, ascots and striped trousers, and it's closer to the look of the actual Zombies than the fucking cowboy hat guys. The second fake Zombies band were a five-piece from Marquette, Michigan, that was right in Delta Promotions' backyard. They were made up of members of a band called the Excels, which was a Beach Boys-inspired band who likely played Band Canyon, the club that Bill Kehoe owned. And they were a regional success during the mid-60s and recorded a number of singles that charted on local radio. But they were like the perfect band to be turned into a Zombies sound alike. Tom Hocutt says they were so damn good. They were the perfect Zombies. If you heard them play Time of the Season, you couldn't tell the difference.
So are we going to get to hear and see any of these bands?
No. I mean, we can listen. No? We can hear the Excels, but no recording of the fake Zombies bands exist. If you want to listen to the Excels, we can.
Yeah, I do.
So this is a song called Gonna Make You Mine, Girl by the Excels. This is much closer to the Zombie sound than like a Texas blues band is.
Yeah.
I have no fucking idea why they went to Texas for this first.
That is so strange. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Just a little bop.
Little bop, right?
Yeah.
So they were so good that Delta Promotions felt comfortable increasing the size and scale of tours. They had a tour bus. We sent a road manager out with them. On October 21st, 1969, the Michigan Zombies were playing at the Whiskey A Go-Go in Los Angeles. And some friends of the original Zombie member, Paul Atkinson, went to the gig and managed to get the Imposters on tape. Quote.
And we don't have it?
No, we don't have it. So this is Chris White's quote. Quote, he had someone go along with a tape recorder as a journalist. Tape as in like recording of tape, not videotape.
Hmm.
They had a guitar player calling himself Grundy, who is the name, which was the name of the the Zombies drummer. They asked him why he was now out front as the singer, and he said in a Northern England accent, well, the boys wanted me out front and I'm the only original member. And then the interviewer said, didn't you used to be 5'10"? This guy is 5'6". And Chris White says, we had it on tape, but I don't know where it's gone to now. So they lost the tape.
What the hell?
By December of 1969, word made it back to the real Zombies. And Chris White chastised the Imposters in a Rolling Stone article, which is where this quote was from. Chastised them for, quote, taking money from our fans and dragging down our reputation. He goes on to recount an incident where the fake Zombies had the cheek, quote, the cheek to phone up the record label in Dallas, or from Dallas, and ask for $1,000 in publicity money.
No way.
Dusty Hill refutes this accusation, quote, we were just making whatever we were making, and we were happy to get some money to get another band together, but we didn't do that. That being asked for $1,000. It wouldn't surprise me if Bill Kehoe did it, though. So the Zombies, the actual Zombies, Rod Argent, later admitted to Sound on Sound, quote, it did infuriate us. We were actually offered a huge amount of money to reform after Time of the Season was number one. But by that time, we had already, all of us, embarked on different courses, and it didn't feel right to just chase the buck and abandon everything else, even though it was very tempting in material returns. It was a moment of madness. So the other people leapt into the void and tried to cash in. In most cases, as I mentioned this earlier, in most cases, Delta Promotions would claim that the band had one original member, as it did with the Saginaw News. And when Rolling Stone contacted Bill Kehoe for a comment in that December 1969 article, he claimed that the American Zombies, formed after the lead singer of the Zombies was killed and the two other guys left. He goes on to brazenly admit to the magazine that the current Zombies are the second incarnation that he's created. Quote, they're not a new group. They used to be the Excels. He just admits it.
It's so crazy what you can get away with before the internet, fucking cell phones.
The fucking 60s, man. Eventually, at least two other imitation Zombie bands were playing in the U.S.
But this begs the question, like, what other bands were
faked? That's a great fucking question. Chris White recounts a meeting at CBS Records in New York. Promoters at a radio station noticed that the Zombies were coming to town. And they wanted to talk to him. Chris White, and Chris said, well, that's not the real zombies. We're here. They said, we don't know. You might be the fake zombies. How do I know you're really Chris White? That's when we decided to go back and do a third album and establish that we're alive. So the zombies, Jesus. The actual zombies reform to fight the imposters, musically, that is.
Well, I guess we have the imposters to thank for that, then.
I guess so. Reforming the band wasn't something anyone was eager to do, and Rod Argent and Chris White had a new band called Argent, and Colin Bloodstone had started his solo career, sometimes referring to himself as the zombies.
But didn't he join an insurance firm or something?
One of the other ones did.
Not Colin.
I don't think so. But the existence of the fake zombies provided a strong incentive. If a fan went to see the imposter band and left disappointed, it's unlikely that they'd purchase a record or buy a ticket to a future concert by one of the real band's members. But despite their efforts, so they went into the studio in like 1969, 1970 to record a new album, but they abandoned that recording and they wouldn't release that album until 2010.
What?
And that album is called R.I.P.
Nailed it. Why did they wait?
They kept breaking up and reforming, basically. But this is a zombies recording from the late 60s, early 70s that made it into R.I.P. and eventually was released in 2010. It's called She Loves the Way They Love Her. So it's got like some fake crowd noise.
This is called the original studio recordings, meaning of the third album.
It was like a greatest hits. Because the zombies only ever released those three albums, they have like a million greatest hits recordings include the same songs. You know, I really like this band a lot, but I think at this point the magic is kind of gone and they sound just kind of like a Beatles sound alike.
But it sounds a little more modern.
Yeah,
which I think it was,
that,
I guess.
That might be because they finished it in 2010, but yeah, I don't.
They finished in 2010?
They released it in 2010. I think that they probably remixed it and remastered it before they released it. She loves the way he loves her. I don't hate it. I'm just like, it's not Odyssey and Oracle to me.
Right. I like it, but yeah. Definitely a little different of a sound.
A little different.
It's okay.
Meanwhile, Delta Promotions wasn't content with just doing this with two zombies bands. The beginning of the end came when a fake version of the Animals created by Delta was confronted at a performance by the singer of the real Animals.
Oh, shit.
So the Animals sang House of the Rising Sun. Mm-hmm. Huge hit. And the founder of the actual Animals, Eric Burdon, according to an article in the May 28th issue of Rolling Stone by Ben Fong Torres of Almost Famous fame.
Amazing.
So Eric Burdon had shown up to the show with a baseball bat.
Just by coincidence?
No, not by coincidence. He knew that this fake Animals band was touring, showed up to the show, and was going to crack a head open.
Oh, my God.
Tom Hocutt remembers getting a phone call from one of the fake Animals recounting the same story. Quote, Eric Burdon and a bunch of bikers chased them around and threatened them.
Oh, my God.
Burdon was contacted for this story, and his wife responded with an email saying, I asked Eric if he has any recollection of this incident you mentioned, but he doesn't. Maybe because he got hit in the head with a baseball bat.
Holy shit.
The Rolling Stone article also mentions the existence of another fraudulent Delta Promotions group and the one that would finally lead to the company's undoing, the Archies. So the Archies were a cartoon. This is the BuzzFeed article. Not the way Keith Richards or Gene Simmons are cartoons, but actual cartoons like Archie and Jughead. They were a fictitious band comprising the characters from the Archie Comics universe, which was an entity controlled by a producer named Don Kirshner. Don Kirshner also created the Monkees. Kirshner was a shrewd businessman, and he took the popularity of the comic book characters and turned it into a huge hit record for the Archies, Sugar Sugar.
Dun, 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 dun.
That's the Archies. That song sung by a cartoon. So the Archies, like what Dusty Hill was told, the Archies are a studio-only band, right? They don't actually exist. They are session musicians as cartoons.
Like the California Raisins.
Like the California, exactly. So Hoka believes that the fake Archies consisted of members of a folk group called the Bluesberry Jam.
Bluesberry Jam.
I only included that so I could say Bluesberry Jam.
I love it.
While it might seem like this would be the easiest con to pull off for Delta, since there were no real Archies at all, this was not the case. Unlike the disbanded rock bands and their labels, Kirshner Productions was a well-oiled machine ready to take down any dubious claims to the music of its properties. Quote, "We heard about this group and our lawyers are taking action," Kirshner told Rolling Stone. Kirshner's words in the magazine must have given Bill Kehoe cause for concern, because just 2 weeks after the article ran, a headline appeared in the Bay City Times, quote, "Band promoter quits, blasts DJs, comma, mafia." The article was Kehoe's attempt to get out in front of the controversy, and he expressed disgust and exhaustion with the music business without mentioning the lawsuits and baseball bats encroaching on the Delta operation. Quote, we never represented to anyone that these were the same groups who made the records, Bill Kehoe claimed. This is in direct opposition to statements from disc jockeys and promoters in the Rolling Stone story who say Delta provided phony affidavits claiming that the band featured original members.
Oh my God.
One DJ says such documents were promised by Delta but never delivered. He also like claims that he was like shot at in his office and he had to run and he thinks the mafia, which like it may have been. He was dealing drugs out of the office, but I don't think that that's the fake Archie's problem.
Just like why? He's like, oh, it was so exhausting.
It's a real Lou Pearlman situation.
For real.
Later, in the Bay City Times article, Bill turned his ire to the bands themselves. Quote, "In 2 years, I lost $20,000 in the business. One of the groups wrecked a bus we bought for them, and some didn't pay us back the money we advanced them," he said, adding that his pet peeve is, quote, "groups who cheat us every chance they can." The fucking balls on this guy.
Jesus.
He died in 1990 of his balls being too big.
Yeah.
ZZ Top formed in 1969 amid the tour and collapse of the fake zombies band. But they...
And like no repercussions for the musicians?
None. They shouldn't have any repercussions.
I think, if they were lied to.
Yeah. And they claim that the Z's in their name have nothing to do with the zombies. Rather, guitarist Billy Gibbons, who was the only member of ZZ Top who wasn't in the fake band, he wanted to create a band name that paid homage to two blues guitar legends, B.B. King and ZZ Hill. And if you're the king, you're at the top of the hill.
Okay.
Smells suspicious. I think you heard it here first.
They figured it out later.
ZZ Top stands for Zombie Zombie Top. And if you can believe it, this happened again in 1988 in my hometown. So this is from phillyburbs.com. Anticipation was high among the crowd of classic rock lovers packed into the old Kenwood Tavern in Bristol Township, July 12, 1988. British invasion icons, the Zombies, were booked to headline the local club, and while no one expected to see the full original lineup that night, the chance to catch any version of the revered band in such an intimate venue 20 years after the breakup was an obvious draw. A veteran DJ, Ed Syaki, showed up to introduce the band. So the Bucks County Courier Times music critic, that's like the local paper for my town. The Bucks County Courier Times music critic, John Fisher, wrote of his massive expectations for the evening based on the Kenwood Music Hall's recent history of attracting reformed versions of popular acts from the 60s because Blue Oyster Cult had played there 6 months earlier.
Ah.
It was going to be a night to remember. And it was, just not for the reason anyone expected. As it turns out, you could have rounded up any five musicians from any neighborhood bar in America, and they would have resembled the Zombies as much as the band that took the stage that night. Co-lead singers Rod Argent and Colin Blunstone obviously weren't there, but neither were to guitarist Paul Atkinson, bassist Chris White, or drummer Hugh Grundy. That didn't stop promoters, one of whom apparently was the lead singer of the fake act, from billing the show as The Zombies, as opposed to calling it The Zombies Tribute Act. And even that would have been misleading.
But unaffiliated.
Completely unaffiliated, but it seems like one of the promoters was the singer of the fake Zombies.
Right, but unaffiliated with any of the first fake Zombie plays.
It just completely it happened again, completely independently.
Wow.
So the opening act was a blues rock guitarist named Billy Goodman. And he said, quote, "We were pumped to play. It was a good show for us to open, where hopefully there'd be a big crowd and we'd be able to put ourselves up against the veteran band. We had no idea at the time that they were the fake Zombies. We didn't know until the night of the gig, immediately when they started playing.
As soon as they opened their mouth."
Literally. It didn't take long for the drummer, Steve Sheave, whose quote we just heard. It didn't take long for Steve Sheave and his bandmates and everyone else in the bar to realize that the band on stage was definitely not the Zombies. According to the Bucks County Courier-Times music review of the show, the band played just three Zombies songs, She's Not There, Tell Her No, and Time of the Season, and otherwise was just a British Invasion covers band, and not a very good one either. Quote, "I don't know where they got those guys," Sheave said. "It was kind of disappointing. I always liked the Zombies, and I was excited to meet some of the people I looked up to when I was a kid. But these guys were younger than we were."
Oh my God.
"We knew something was wrong when they got up and played. Who are these guys? They were really, it was not a good show."
Yeah, if you're like a great cover band, people would probably still have a good time.
Yeah. So John Fisher, the
So why do they do this?
Who the fuck knows? I mean, to make money, but like, why did it happen with the Zombies at least five times? Who can say?
Like, if you do like a Beatles tribute band, you're probably going to sell out because no one has anything to do.
Correct. And you don't have to bill yourselves as the actual Beatles.
Right. So I'm just confused why this is happening.
Fucking wild. So John Fisher, the late music critic of the Bucks County Courier Times, quote, "didn't have a single nice thing to say," writing, "what was billed as a Zombies show in reality was an English Invasion rock retrospective, and unfortunately, it was one that really was not even done that well. More than a few musicians in attendance could be found wincing during exceptionally bad points of the show."
Oh my God.
"The real, actual Zombies, much like the Zombies from the movies, keep rising from the dead. They reunited in the 90s, the 2000s, the 2010s, 2017 for the 50th anniversary of Odyssey and Oracle. In 2019, they co-headlined a tour with Brian Wilson and Al Jardine from the Beach Boys called Something Great from 68. And the band was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2019. And they're still touring and playing today. They even went to Michigan in 2023 at the Royal Oak Music Hall. No word if they pulled any of the fake Zombies on stage with them." What are we going out on this week, Lindsay?
Zombie. Hey.
From the Cranberries.
Find us on the internet at Lyrics for Lunch on Instagram and Twitter. And for longer and weirder stuff, send us an email at lyricsforlunch@gmail.com.
Give us a rate and review wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your friends about us. Tell your enemies about us. Tell your fake cover bands about us.
And if you want to support the show, go to lyricsforlunch.com and click support the show.
And tune in next week when we talk again about a band that is doubling... disguised as a band, doubling for another band.
I don't think we're doing that next week.
We might do it again my next time. I have like another
2 weeks from now.
I have like another doubles one that I had in my back pocket.
All right. Well, buckle in.
Until then, I'm Avi Rubenstein.
I'm Lindsay Tucker.
Saying,
what's your name?
Who's your daddy?